Welcome to season two of the Triple Existential Podcast. I'm your host, Ebi Cote Nord.
My designer handbag is full. My designer handbag is filled with an ice cream container full of freezer burned jizz, a condiment bottle of my urine, and approximately four dildos. As I cross the lobby of this boutique motel in downtown Chicago to go see the vice president of a Fortune 50 who, for some unknown reason, thinks his name is Mike. It's not. He's been drinking my pee for a fucking year, and he doesn't know he told me his name before we even met. I push the button that tells the elevator to take me to the top floor, and as the doors close, I make eye contact with my reflection and sigh. This is my glamorous life as a high-end escort. This is both entirely surreal and entirely typical, except the freezer burn. How'd you get into this? Not Mike asks. They all ask me that question at some point. I'm more curious how they got into this. I've never asked, it's not my place, but I really want to know how you decide that you're going to call a stranger on the internet and ask her to hold the secrets you don't tell your wife or even your therapist. And why do you think I think her name is Mike? A friend got me into it, I tell them. I'm way too lazy to concoct the whole backstory that I have to remember, so I just give them the extremely abbreviated version. If they ask more questions, I throw in details like how my marriage was open for years before I started, and something about it being a natural transition. It's all mostly true, enough truth that I can keep track of it, enough lie that I feel like they're getting their money's worth. The lies are mostly lies of omission. The heroin-addicted mother with postpartum depression that I had a crush on and wanted to impress, the psychiatric hospitals, the felony charges. Aggravated felony on a police officer. More than one count of aggravated felony battery on a police officer. And when I pleaded it out, the officers I was accused of feloniously battering in an aggravated manner didn't feel the need to come in and testify about how injured they were. The victims declined to make impact statements, according to the district attorney. I would have loved to see them walking in coated in Kevlar, wrapped in straps with snaps, securing a buffet of weapons to their bodies to testify how I, a pretty middle-aged, middle-class suburban mom from Chicago's North Shore, freckles and all, was too much for a team of them to control. I would have loved to hear about how injured they were physically and emotionally after I feloniously battered them while drunk and chock full of Xanax. Despite my attorney insisting that, for sentencing purposes, it was a good thing they didn't make statements, there's a smug and cynical part of me that still longs for a court transcript of that testimony to keep in my bag so I can perform dramatic readings of it at parties. 9 months in prison is a price I might have been willing to pay for that. But they didn't testify. I didn't either. I just admitted that there was some truth to what the arrest reports claimed. I pled out instead. I pled that I struck an officer in the groin with my foot and drew blood while striking another and spat in the face of yet another. But I pled that there was no felony intent, that my intent was to commit a misdemeanor. By pleading, I admitted that I intended to assault and batter multiple individuals, but not because they were police officers. I didn't intend to hurt them specifically because they were police officers. And just because I specifically uttered at the top of my lungs that this had everything to do with them being police officers, there was no reason for anyone to think that this actually had anything to do with them being police officers. Were my actions aggravated? I think there was plenty of aggravation on the part of everyone involved. I'd rather not point figures. I just feel like we were all aggravated and we all bear that responsibility as a group on both sides. The judge, being a woman of reason, agreed. I am merely a violent offender of misdemeanors. I am no felon. I arrived at the hospital days after my arrest. A year and a half before I pled my case. I checked into the hospital as an alleged felon. I still miss carrying that title. You don't get to keep any part of it if you end up without a felony conviction. It's not like when you lose at the Oscars, but you always get to say that you were an Academy Award nominee. There are no felony nominees, only convicts and acquittals and pled down to a misdemeanor. I was an alleged felon, though. When I checked into the hospital, it was a fresh allegation. I went to the hospital straight from arraignment. It felt like a cynical strategy on my family's part. My attorney decided it would be best for my case if I immediately sought psychiatric help after being arrested. It occurs to me now, years later, that maybe getting drunk and choking down pills at a family reunion in Wisconsin and then running off and beating down teams of cops is the type of behavior that is legitimately concerning enough to warrant a couple days of observation by a mental health professional and have somebody who could maybe poke around my head a little bit and be like, hey, you doing okay? What was that cop thing all about? Maybe we should adjust your Xanax intake. It's all a bit too much to bring up in a session. No one needs to hear all those details. They think they want to hear all those details, but the real details aren't racy. I'm not motivated enough to conjure up fake ones. My backstory, the one of me entering sex work, is decidedly unsexy. It's equal parts interesting and cliche, but it's not sexy. So I leave them out. Those stories are for different rooms and different ears. Those stories are for people who don't think I think their name is Mike.
Hi, welcome to the Triple Existential Podcast with Ebi Kotenord. This is Ebi Kotenord, and tonight I am quitting the show and giving the show over to my friend Steve Gadlin, and he's taking it over, and it's totally his show, and he was kind enough to invite me on as a guest. The interesting thing about me and Steve is that Steve does not actually know me as EB. He knows me in real life as Elise. So now he's going to be learning, or if he wants to, I guess it's his show. He can do what he wants about me as this woman that he doesn't know, but kind of does. So here we go. Steve, it's your show.
All right.
Triple Existential Podcast with Steve
Gadlin.
Welcome
to my show. And that's coincidentally what I call my show as well. So, you know, I feel like I'm just back on my show.
Yeah. Well, it is your show. Now you've got two shows named the Triple Existential
Podcast
with Steve Gadlin.
That's going to get really confusing for my regular subscribers. So I'll have to distinguish. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I am. My mind is spinning, absolutely spinning.
Well, yeah, because now you've got two Triple Existential Podcasts, which is probably like something that would make your head spin.
Yeah. Also, this story is incredible.
Oh, well, thank you.
It's incredible. I think, you know, my theory is a life well lived. And I don't know that anyone's judging or scoring our lives, but a life well lived is one filled with story-worthy experiences. And this is one that I mean, I've never been through something like this, right? That's just incredible.
Which, so is it the elevator that you've never been in, or?
Well, the handbag stuff was all almost literally pulled from my day-to-day.
Right. So that, I mean, I was actually writing that story about you.
I figured.
I took it from your diary.
Well, that's fine. And that's fine. No, but at the experience with the police for sure is, you know, that's, you know, part of that. I probably wouldn't find myself in that same experience because I'm a guy, right? It's not going to be, I wouldn't have the same types of interactions.
Well, but, this was, I mean, I was at a family reunion.
Yeah.
So, I mean, guys go to family reunions. I know because I saw my family there and there were guys.
Well, not real men. I don't know what kind of guys these were. Family reunion. I don't know. That's I don't know. It's.
But then I got drunk and I took a bunch of Xanax and I beat up a bunch of cops. So,
yes.
Yeah.
And that's the part where it, you know, I don't know that I'd ever find myself down that road. And I say that not in a judgy way at all. I say that fully, like, I think that's great that happened. You know, when I was in college, I consumed Charles Bukowski and thought I was cool because I read about stuff like that, you know? But never in my life have I lived something like that. And I'm sure you don't look back on this fondly, right?
As... I mean, I'm not. Okay, so there's something that's like, you know, there's a certain like cachet about like getting to say like, yeah, I am an alleged felon.
Yeah, no, that's awesome.
Yeah, but I don't get to do that anymore. So like I get to be like, once I was an alleged felon, but
okay,
now well, I'm just a violent offender, which actually like it's cool like at parties when people like see me because I look very much like, you know, your pretty average suburban mom. And yeah, then I'm like, sure. Well, yeah, actually, I'm a violent offender. But it actually isn't great for things like getting employed or renting apartments.
Okay. And I guess I'm trivializing it in that way, right? I mean, yes, it's a cool tattoo, but it's a face tattoo, right? And it's hard to to talk your way through when you're signing your name to something or looking for a job. Totally understand that.
Totally cool at parties, face tattoos, depending on the party. I look less like a suburban mom with a face tattoo. So I haven't gotten one because I kind of like that, like, you know, like Clark Kent thing. Like, you know,
I need to give you some juxtaposition here because I want to tell you the closest story I can.
Okay.
To the one that you've told, which is when I was in college. I wasn't even drinking this. I was giddy on sugar, probably on cans of Coca-Cola. From a dorm vending machine.
Okay.
And with a friend of mine, we were thumbing through the campus phone book and found someone named Lincoln Butts.
No.
Yeah. So I said, we're going to prank him. So we picked up the rotary phone that, not to age myself, but there was a rotary phone in this dorm room, or maybe a push button, but you know, one of those ones that you pick up and put to your ear.
Not even like a cordless.
No, not a cordless. There was definitely a cord. We called Lincoln Butts. We dialed his 4-digit phone number and shouted, "Hey, you're Lincoln Butts." It wasn't even a clever prank.
That's not even a good call.
No. Yeah. We shouted his name, Butts, Butts, Butts. And then I implicated someone else. I said, "And my name's David, whatever. And here's my dorm room." As a way of, like, you know, getting that guy into some trouble.
Well, nobody likes Dave.
No, they didn't. They absolutely didn't. Dave was actually one of the first born-again Christians that I ever met and would proselytize in the dorm. And, you know, from Chicago, from Skokie, right? That's not something I ever encountered until I went to school in Ohio. But he also happened to be the roommate.
So, is Dave from Skokie?
No.
Oh, okay, because I'm like, you don't meet a lot of, like, evangelical Christians in Skokie.
Truly the first I'd ever encountered and didn't like him at all. But he was also the roommate of the person I was pranking with. So to give his name and dorm room was like the dumbest thing in the world. So later that night, we got wind that, you know, there were cops going through the dorm looking for Dave Fartbutt or whatever. Fartbutt. I can't remember his last name. And eventually, we went out and copped to it because we knew it was happening. Apparently, Lincoln Butts was so tired of people prank calling him or making fun of his name that he called the police, who came to the dorm and made us sign this confession. So I had this confession saying that I did psychologically abuse another. And it prevented me from being an RA. You know, just like your story when you're going for job interviews, at every RA interview I had, they'd send all the other people out of the room and say, "Okay, now we just have to talk about this one thing on your record. You psychologically abused someone. Do you want to talk about that?" Yeah. And, you know, it was hard to talk my way through terrorizing a guy whose last name happened to be Butts.
But really, you should have gotten a medal for what you did to Dave.
Absolutely.
I feel like you should have been like, instead of like it being an RA, they should have made you like king of the dorm for what you did to Dave.
Absolutely. And, you know, the cops even laughed about it and said, you know, Lincoln Butts could have just decided to show up at Dave Northup's door and punch him in the face. And we all had a good laugh over that prospect. And the police report, which I'm sure you're familiar with police reports, they have people's last names are in all caps. So the one we had just had the word Butts all the way through it in all capital letters, which was delightful.
That's glorious.
Yeah. So, you know, when I read your story, I'm like, yeah, I know.
It's like the same thing. It's basically the same thing.
You want to hear the happy ending?
You know how I love happy endings.
I do. So this story, so years later, my wife was still a student at this school. I had graduated by that time, and she was working catering. And she called me to say, you'll never guess whose wedding I'm catering right now. And she was working the Lincoln Butts wedding. He was getting married to a woman named Lisa Snotty.
No, yes, Snotty Butts wedding. Oh, my God.
That makes this almost too good to be true, but it's every word of it is absolutely true. So,
well, I'm so happy Lincoln Butts found love. And he probably found somebody who they could have a good laugh at people who laugh at people's names, I guess.
Possibly. Maybe. I mean, maybe they're still together. You know, her whole life, she was carrying the name Snotty around.
Right.
And was probably, as a little girl, thinking, it's okay, one day I'll marry out of it. And she married right into Butts. So, yeah. Which brings us back to you and your story.
And my story. Yeah. And how I never got to change my name.
Oh. Well,
after that. Like, I still, I mean, I guess I did because, like, I went, you know, I got, now I'm like employed under a different name, under Absolutely. A pseudonym. Now I'm like, oh, what? Elise? In who's that?
Butt related
EB.
Profession.
That's right. I'm not a cop killer. I'm just like some anal lady.
That's amazing. Actually,
different crime.
Lincoln Butts might be a more appropriate name for you at this point. So.
I feel like it's a little heavy-handed.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
It's probably for marketing purposes, maybe a little too on the nose, and then, you know, what do you do with that?
Yeah, so I can't do Lincoln Butts. Plus, that name's already taken.
That's
and
true.
I don't need Lisa Snotty coming after me being like, what you talking about my husband for?
Yeah, I imagine she's incredibly litigious. So I would stay away from that.
I probably would be too. If a bunch of like sex workers were taking my husband's name and like using it for marketing purposes.
Yeah. Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Awesome.
I mean, it's your show, so you can do what you want.
That's true. It is my show. Welcome. You haven't had a drink in a really long time.
It is almost 5 years.
That's incredible.
Yeah. It'll be 5 years in March of 2021. So,
and do you feel like a different person not drinking?
I am far less felonious, okay. For sure. Yeah. I'm definitely a different person. Like, I make sense. I'm not delusional. I'm not beating up cops.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Do you feel like a better person? Are there parts that you miss of that other person?
This is like kind of a dark answer, but like, I feel like a person, you know, I feel like I'm a person. And I was a pretty late stage alcoholic when I got clean. And so I was incredibly delusional. I was really depressed. And, you know, I wasn't functioning anymore. And if I hadn't gotten sober when I did, I probably only had like months left to live. So, yeah, I mean,
because of the alcohol or because of your behavior?
Both. I mean, if I didn't drink myself to death, I probably would have hurt myself drinking. It was a bad, bad place. And I don't miss that. And I didn't even enjoy it. Like, you know, when you're that far along in your addiction, like, it's not fun. You're not drinking because like, it's a good time party.
Yeah.
You know, nobody's like, hey, it's Tuesday. What am I going to do? I'm going to throw up on the kitchen floor at 10 a.m. and lay there for 3 days while my kids step around me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
that's hard.
It's a fun party when you're like 20, but it's not fun when you're in your 30s anymore.
Okay.
So, you know, it's a good, I mean, well, actually, it's a good time, like at a frat house where you're like, hey, yeah, I passed out in the kitchen for 3 days. Like, then it's, you're probably still an alcoholic.
Yeah, but you can bounce back a little quicker. That you can mention
not,
that
it's
part
not
of
like
the job.
Your children. It's far less dark, you know.
Yeah,
you have
absolutely.
People like cheering you on, and less people like sobbing and being like, mom.
Wow.
See, but yeah, it got bad. And so I'm here, and like, I feel like I have, you know, anything at all that I have is something that I'm grateful for, which is kind of cheesy to say, but I'm really lucky to have made it.
I think too, though, and maybe this is dark and terrible, but again, you've lived through an experience that makes you a, I don't want to say better person, but it, I don't know, you've squeezed more out of life for it, right? You've been through it and you're alive to talk about it. And you have some stories that, I don't care how they go over in a job interview. Those aren't the important ones, right? It's, the fact that you can tell stories, I think that's amazing. So that's cool. Not like, hey, congratulations on having been an alcoholic. I don't mean that at all.
Well, I think that there's definitely something to be said for a good story.
And, oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, life is worth good stories, and I would rather have good stories than, you know, an office job. But
yeah.
And, yeah. But there's too, there's some things that, like, I'm kind of like, I don't know. There's some things that maybe I'd like a little less story out of, like, you know, the stuff that, like, actually, like, traumatized my children is the stuff that I.
Oh, absolutely.
But, you know, they've got their stories now.
They've lived through them.
They have. Yeah. And they're really compassionate people. So I'm really fortunate about that.
Are they forgiving to you for stuff they've gone through?
They are. They really are. And they're really understanding. And it's really amazing that they've actually done street outreach to do harm reduction for, like, people who live on the streets to have drug addictions. And, you know, they'll hand out Narcan and they'll hand out, like, clean, you know, using supplies, you know, and they're just like, you know, they're like, these, you know, they see it from the perspective of somebody who knows it so intimately. And they're like, you know, these people aren't out here because they're having fun. They're out here because this is what they need to do. And, like, who the hell are we to judge? They're doing what they got to do.
That's so incredible.
It's really amazing to see such young kids having, like, that level of compassion, like, you know, so I'm super proud of that.
You should be. I think too, you know, again, not to like trivialize or joke about any of your experiences, but like that you've been able to imbue your kids with that kind of adult thought. I don't know. That's cool. Right. It's not to say that any of what you've been through is worth that, but that's incredible that there are kids who think about that stuff. And, you know, I don't know. I feel, again, my stories are far tamer than your stories. And as a result, you know, my kids really enjoy video games, right? They're not going to go hand out Narcan. I couldn't talk that compassion into them at this age, right? They haven't lived experiences that make them understand that type of thing. So
they know how to check. They know how to tell who's sus, though, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sus. I'm crazy sus.
Yeah, we're all sus. Like, but I mean, like, orange is always sus. Right? Am I wrong?
You're good. See, when I try to use those words, my kids spot it instantly and they laugh at me. And I can't sound as smooth as you do.
Oh, well, I'm glad I sound smooth because I actually played it once.
Okay.
So, yeah, we're talking about Among Us. You know we're talking about Among Us,
I do
right?
know we're talking about Among Us. Yeah.
So I played Among Us
listeners
once.
Listeners of my podcast know that's all pretty much all I talk about. So they're all well. They understand the lingo, too.
So I played Among Us, like, once one night, and I was really bad at it. And they're like, you can't just, like. Yeah, I was venting in front of people, and apparently you can't.
Vent.
Yeah, if you vent in front of people, they know that you're sus, and then you get
for
kicked.
Sure.
So you're not even sus. They know that you're the one that's among them.
I made the rookie mistake of playing with my volume on, and I didn't know what button to press to kill people, and I was the murderer or whatever. So my little boy, he sees my character just walk up to him and sees that I'm trying to do something, and he says, "Dad, what are you doing?" And then from my phone, you hear a very loud as so I finally figure out which button means stab. So all my kids, they all looked at me and understood, okay.
Dad's trying to kill
him. You suck. But
so dad's trying to kill us. I mean, I feel like that's maybe something that we could talk about in therapy later.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So my version of your story of getting through your addictions is that I'm attempting dry January this year, which again, so I know how you feel.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm doing dry January this year too. So we're in this together. How's it going for you?
Well, it was fine. I made it to the 20th, the 19th, the night before the inauguration. I bought a bottle of Maker's 46 to toast our 46th president.
And I had some feel of that. I feel like that's a very special circumstance that you get a pass on.
So that's not the equivalent of like a relapse after, let's say, 5 years of.
You know what? You go and you hand in your chip and you tell everyone in the room that you fucked up and you take the shame.
Yeah.
And you start over.
All right. That's not a full on relapse. I mean,
it's a full on relapse and you should feel terrible about yourself and cry and maybe like drink 4 more bottles. No, don't do that. Actually. You should probably just be like, no, it's cool because I'm just doing dry January and we just got rid of one of the worst things to ever happen to America. So
we did.
So let's just cheers.
You know, I was trying a dry month the month that Ruth Bader Ginsburg died and decided that was reason enough to drink as well. So maybe I'm fishing a little too hard for reasons, but those are both huge things.
Those are big. So here's what I did. Yeah. I was like blackout drunk for like almost the entire Obama administration.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then I got sober in 2016.
Oh, no.
So I did the whole Trump thing totally without drugs or alcohol.
That's amazing.
So God bless me. Like,
no, for real. That's insane.
Oh,
that's incredible.
I was like, man, I fucked up. I fucked up the order here.
Where do you find the strength to stay sober through events like that? Through just looking, or I mean, you know, the world was really fucked for a long time. How do you, I don't know, what drives you to that? How are you successful at that? You shouldn't be.
I shouldn't be. Like, honestly, I think I'm lucky. I mean, I think that I'm lucky enough to have been able to do it. Because I don't know.
All right.
And I wish I had a better answer, but like, you know, I guess the only thing I know is that I'm worse when I drink. So the only thing that, like, I could control is like, if I don't drink, it won't, like, if I drink, it'll only be worse.
Okay.
And, you know, I don't think that needed to be worse.
I hope I'm not seeding you with doubt or anything like, oh yeah, how am I doing that? Maybe, okay.
Yeah, no.
Gotta figure if you made it through the Trump administration, there's nothing I can say that.
I kind of think I don't need to know how to do it. Like, I did it. So like, and that's kind of like how I do everything in life. It's like, how'd you do it? I don't know. How are you going to do that? I don't know. And then, you know, next thing you know, it's done. So
that's a great strategy.
It is.
Yeah. And it makes you far less pretentious and annoying too.
Oh, you don't think pretentious and annoying? That's like the nicest thing anyone said to me.
Well, you're not lecturing me about how you did this and how I should do this. And
we just talked about how I got drunk and took a handful of Xanax at a family reunion and beat up a bunch of cops. So maybe like throwing some stones is a bad idea in this glass little house I'm in.
That's a good point. Good point. I guess, yes, you are. you have very little risk of ever sounding pretentious with those.
Yeah. Like, oh, you had a couple of drinks at the inauguration. Well, I bet you should be ashamed of yourself. I mean, I did tell you to be ashamed of yourself. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And I will be, believe me, I will be. Oh, man. So how with your career, right? Obviously, you see like a really interesting slice of people, but obviously, you've got to keep a lot of that to yourself, right? So, how do you, you know, I know you know, you can write stories and tell stories and use pseudonyms and that type of stuff, but that you must carry a lot of interesting stuff that you just can't discuss. How does, what kind of effect does that have on you?
Wow. It's, I think, I mean, you take so much with you, and I think that's why I write, because like, there's so many amazing stories about amazing people in amazing situations, and it's funny and it's glorious and it's dark. And like, I feel like it's all of these extremes, and I'm not somebody who's not good at sharing everything. So I have to find ways to do it. And, yeah, you know, writing is one way that I'm finding the, it's such an interesting experience that I have to share it. I have to share it, you know, and I think that, you know, being a sex worker is such an interesting experience, and people have this idea of it being like dark and sad and tragic. And I'm like, you know, it can be, but it doesn't have to be. And there's parts of my story that are dark and tragic, but there's also, you know, being in an elevator with a Talenti jar full of someone else's jizz that I'm taking to a client who thinks, you know, he's like, oh yeah, my name is Mike. I'm like, your name's not fucking Mike, you know? Sorry, can I swear on your podcast?
Yeah, please.
Okay.
you can. That's really wild. And, you know, how do you feel about the people in your stories, right? I mean, obviously you've been through so much. You've got to approach this with some level of empathy, right? You know, you're talking about people and activities that traditionally people would really frown upon and feel are associated with sadness and you know, aimlessness. I don't know the right words to use here. But I think, do your experiences and your dark past help you empathize, or what? I don't know.
I guess I don't see my past as necessarily the thing that makes me empathize. I feel like people are what make me empathize. You know, I'm in this room with somebody who is trusting me with like all of their secrets.
Yeah.
And, you know, and their body, and I'm trusting them with mine. And, you know, that's such a vulnerable place to be. So to not have empathy for that, you know, I wouldn't know how to do that.
Sure. But,
you know, one thing that I say, and I really mean this, is that I believe that every single person that anyone comes into contact with, everyone, you know, we all have something that makes us lovable and likable and worthy of love and compassion. And, you know, we are all worthy of being desired. And I want to find that in every single person that I come into contact with through work. And, you know, so when I'm in the room, like that's my only thing that I'm trying to feel. And I'm pretty, wow. I like to think that I'm pretty good at finding it. And I, you know,
sometimes
can't say
you say like, oh, we need another hour. I haven't found it yet.
You know, I just don't think you're that likable yet. Maybe we need 4 more hours.
Oh man.
Like, I mean, several thousand dollars would make me like you a lot more, you know?
Of course. That's really cool to hear. I guess it's just an interesting take that I don't know, that's not something I would assume is ever happening in a transaction like that, right? And I assume there must also be a lot of the opposite, a lot of the, oh, what a despicable human being, right? Is that, how can there not be, you know?
I allow myself to think that after the fact, you know, if it's necessary, yeah. But like while I'm with them, no, like that's not something that like I'm allowed to think of the person that I'm with, because I can't do what I'm there to do if I'm thinking that. It doesn't mean that, you know, but just because somebody's lovable doesn't mean they're likable. And it doesn't mean they're likable overall. I don't have to like them when I leave the room, but I have to love them when I'm with them.
Oh, wow. And that's like the same thing at my job, to be honest. As a digital marketer.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm kidding. I can't think of one.
Well, what about like drawing cats? You feel the same way, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Like, yeah, I feel like it's the same thing.
Drawing cats, I think, is almost a parallel profession.
You're like, I love you while I'm drawing you, and then I hate you when I leave the room, and then...
Well, it turns out I'm not cut out for it because I'm far less empathetic, and I'll get orders and say instantly, like, I hate you. You person that's making me draw a cat on a horse that is so hard for me, and I hate you for making me do this, and I'm not, you know, and I have no love for that customer at all.
But you know, partially, bring people so much joy. Like, I've gotten cat drawings from you, and like, awesome. They always make me happy. Like,
well, that's a defect on your end. That's not skill on my end.
It is.
That's, you know, I love that they make people happy. And I do appreciate that every customer in what I do with the cat drawing stuff is like a personal relationship and a pen pal. And there are definitely customers, you know, there's actually a woman whose husband is, I don't know what his addiction is, but he's now, I think, 9 or 10 years sober. And every year they market with the cat drawing. And every year I wait for that order to come in, just crossing my fingers that they haven't relapsed in that time. You know, so there's a lot of, you know, stick figure cat drawing business. No one's going to assume there's that type of personal connection. But I've drawn about 15 proposals for people, right? And I've been part of some really special moments. And then this one time, this guy made his brother smoke his pubes and revealed to him that he made him smoke pubes via cat drawing. So again, these real close family moments.
Yeah.
Very, yeah. So, but I do think, so there is a parallel.
There really is.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't get to be part of proposals very often.
No, well, that's a good point.
Girlfriends are really not huge fans of me being around for the proposal, so.
Yeah, but like a tangential sort of relationship management parallel.
But I sometimes get to show up at the bachelor party, so there's always that part of the the courtship process.
There you go. So we just played. We're in the same process. We're at different points of it.
Yeah, it's like the last time he gets anal, ladies. So just it's because you don't ever have to do it again now that you're married.
Yeah, and it's actually the last time with a proposal. Last time you can get away with only spending $10 on a gift for your significant other. So
he gets you a cat drawing, and then he gets himself like the last anal encounter of his single life, and then you guys go march down the aisle and live happily ever after.
Yes,
and
as they do,
marriages always work out.
Absolutely.
Especially when somebody's seeking anal the night before the wedding.
Yeah. And when you kick it off with such thoughtful custom art, you know?
Yeah. So do you ever follow up and like find out like, oh, are you still married after you propose with the cat drawing?
I don't follow up, but I did hear back from one person who ordered 1 year later, and they did mention that the marriage didn't stick. I would imagine that's the case with most of them. And I did draw a cat recently for someone whose girlfriend of a year had just broken up with him. And I was it was a drawing of a cat saying like, I still love you and I miss you. And, you know, if I were an ethical cat artist, I'd have said, no, buddy, just trust me. this is not going to help things, you know, but I got to take the $10 when
I get the $10. It's
$10. So I drew it. Now, I would like to follow up on that one because, for all I know, cat drawing did the trick and they are deeply in love again. Who knows?
And I expect to hear from him.
Oh, yeah.
Right,
I'm sure.
The wedding, like.
That's right. Eventually. So you tell me. His name was Lincoln Butts. If he, if he comes through.
You know, surprisingly, I have had clients tell me that their marriages are better.
Yeah.
Because of me and my relationship with the husband that the wife may not know about, but.
Okay. So you've had the one half of the relationship tells you things are better.
I mean, you know, I mean, like, I don't know if they actually are. I think that there's
probably
times that I
them.
Can tell that it's better, you know,
okay.
But you know, I think that there's something to be said for, you know, there's all this weird shame around the things that we desire and who we can do them with. And it's like, you know, if you want to do like the dirty stuff, like you can't do that with your wife because like you love her and respect her and you're like, you have to like look at her and she's the mother of your children and she doesn't do the weird stuff. Mm-hmm. But, and really that's like, that's absolutely bullshit. And it's a shame that people feel that way. But there's also wives that feel that way about themselves. And, you know, you have desires and you have needs, and being able to have an outlet where you can explore those things without causing tension in your marriage, or it's caused tension in your marriage and now you're able to like get rid of that because you're like, I'm just going to handle it over here. You know, whether that's great for the trust aspects of your relationship, you know, I don't know that there's really great ways to handle it, but yeah, I think it's really important to be able to have those needs met because it's part of who you are. You know, your sexuality is not, you know, some trivial thing. It's a part of who you are. And it's an important part of how you experience the world. So being able to have that outlet and have those experiences and live your life without having to put this pressure on your marriage to, you know, explore that, I think does save relationships in some cases.
You're probably right. I think, right, the perfect version of that is exactly what you're saying, but with total transparency, right? With all parties involved acknowledging everything you just said and agreeing with everything you just said.
But, you know, there's a lot of wives that aren't going to be like, no, that's cool, go ahead.
Sure.
And at that point, you have to decide, am I going to... You know, it gets real complicated. It gets real complicated. And I used to not have a lot of compassion for that. I'd be like, you know, you're cheating on your wife. You're such a fucking piece of shit. But now I'm like, you know, I can't, you know, you can't walk a mile in my Louboutins and I can't walk a mile in your flats. So.
And I'm sure you've seen it play out. I'll say tens of times or hundreds, tens.
And
tens,
other people hundreds. In my Louboutins? Hell no. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, I guess we should probably wrap this up, huh?
Yeah,
we've been talking a while.
It's fun having you on my podcast.
Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you again, this is pretty much the same thing we talk about every week on my podcast. So yawn to my, you know, my regular listeners are yawning, but sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Another hooker, another week.
Yeah. I didn't know we'd get there again, but yeah, there we were.
Thank you so much, Steve. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. I appreciate you. It was such a great talk. Hopefully we talk again soon.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.